Willkommen zu einer neuen Folge von Erlebnis Irland, dem Podcast, der die Geschichten, Menschen und Geheimnisse der Grünen Insel lebendig macht. Mein Name ist Felicitas und heute begeben wir uns auf eine faszinierende Reise in die irische Bronzezeit. Unser Gast ist der renommierte Archäologe Michael Gibbons. Er hat kürzlich ein bislang unbekanntes bronzezeitliches Fort entdeckt. Ein Fund, der nicht nur Irlands Geschichte abbildet, sondern auch spannende Parallelen zu mitteleuropäischen Kulturen aufzeigt. Was erzählt uns dieses Fort über das Leben vor über 3000 Jahren? Welche Rätsel gibt es noch zu lösen? Und was bedeutet dieser Fund für das kulturelle Erbe Irlands? Bleibt dran, es wird spannend. Now I switch to English. Welcome to a new episode of Erlebnis Ireland, the podcast that brings to life the stories, people and mysteries of the Emerald Isle. I'm Felicitas, your host today, and we're embarking on a fascinating journey into Ireland's Bronze Age. Our guest is none other than renowned archaeologist Michael Gibbons, who recently discovered a previously unknown Bronze Age fort, a find that not only rewrites parts of Irish history, but also reveals intriguing parallels with Central European cultures. What does this site tell us about life more than 3,000 years ago? What mysteries still remain? And what does this discovery mean for Ireland's cultural heritage? Stay with us, it's going to be exciting! So, hello Michael, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you became interested in archaeology in Ireland?
Well, we grew up in a traditional household, so knowing your history was very important. My mother was very interested in local history, the history of our family. I'm from Connemara, the mountains and the coast. We live right by the sea. So on one farm side, we're fishermen. We went on pilgrimage as kids to our monastic islands, to our holy mountains. And my other side, and my father was from Kylemore, also in and he spent all his life abroad working for a big British company in Africa, in the Middle East, all over Britain. But he was very interested in history growing up, and so we fought the Irish Civil War at home every tea time. So we grew up in a house that which wasn't unusual, you know. History is important in the sort of nationalist house that I grew up in, knowing where you came from and knowing your So we just absorbed it from our parents and the culture around us, where, you know, politics was spoken about, history was discussed as a normal thing, and then people would come into our house because my mother was a native Irish speaker, and we were in an area which is bilingual, and so when I was doing field work here, people would drop notes into our house saying, I have the bed of Dermot and Gráinne, two figures from Irish mythology. So as from a 17-year-old, I was finding megalithic tombs. People were aware that I was interested. A whole range of, and that's still happening. There isn't a month goes by that someone approaches me saying, I was cutting turf, I was down at the sea, we're cutting seaweed, and material is coming up. So it's still very, very, it's an active subject, and I'm a very active archaeologist. I worked director of a national survey program for many years, based in Dublin. So we surveyed three quarters of the country, from Donegal to Waterford. I've worked in Kerry on the uplands, islands. So I suppose I'm an upland, I'm a generalist, so landscape archaeology is what I'm good at, and what I do, and but with an oral history background in it, because if you've got a knowledge of Irish language, it gives you a whole other layer of interpretation in the landscape, which luckily I grew up with. I didn't know I had it. It was just part of our upbringing in Connemara. So place names, folklore, oral history, those are some things I value and trust, because they've brought me to incredible sites of all periods, all ages. So just being open to that has been a hugely significant part of my career as a field archaeologist.
Yeah, I think in every legend there's a nugget of truth. So where if you just listen to it correctly, you can find things other people just go over it and then they don't find it. But if you listen closely, you find, because you open your ears, your eyes, your mind, every sense, and then you go through that place and see, oh, true, it's here. And then you can start digging or can find out about it. So the Irish landscape is a true archaeological archive, and sometimes very, very surprising. So when you go to a site, that you think of, there could be something? What is the first thing which comes into your mind that says, okay, that's here is a good place?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. So some people have an intuition or a sixth sense. It's not terribly scientific, but it has worked historically very well for me. And just having a, why did you go into that valley as opposed to this valley, that island over here? So it's just, in Irish you say expashtarot. So you're rambling through the landscape with a purpose and picking out cues in folklore, landscape, geology, topography, glacial history. And it's all sort of, I'm map reading that the whole time in my head. And the site at Cool Park is a classic example of it. Of how I came to identify that site as a hugely significant site, which had been dismissed, omitted, not taken seriously, though it's in one of the most famous places in Ireland. Cool Park itself is exceptionally important place in terms of literary cultural history of Ireland.
And the funny thing is, as if you talk about mythology and legends, it was also the place where Lady Gregory was there. It's like the Brother Grimm of Ireland. So she invited all the poets there, and they were also writing things about it, but people thought it was like just literal art and not like the essence of it, isn't it?
Well, Lady Gregory was hugely important, much neglected figure, but so she comes from the upper classes and all around her is Gaelic speaking, so she's recognizing that this world is vanishing fast as people are moving to America in very large numbers. But she brings around her a whole, she's aware of Gaelic culture as it's declining rapidly in the late 19th century, as Irish people are historians, anthropologists, folklorists are saying, we're really interested in those folklore, and they're saying, will you hurry up, I'm trying to go to America. So at the time when Irish culture is literally vanishing in their hundreds of thousands to escape Ireland, you have the awareness among the often Protestant upper classes, which is where the interest in archaeology comes from, because deep archaeology is a sort of uncontested past. So Yeats is coming from a colonial background, Lady Gregory is coming from a colonial background, but the distant past is a shared heritage that there's no fighting over. So they play a key role, though they're from the British upper classes, in encouraging and enthusing the Irish, native Irish people, if you like, about their own language and culture and history. So she gathers this incredible ensemble of scholars, poets, writers, revolutionaries around her. And of course she comes to Colmar also, because we have a similar one here in Rinvile Peninsula with Gogarty. And of course the Wildes are very important in that. Oscar Wilde's parents, Francesca Wilde, a folklorist, wonderful woman also, and William Wilde, who was one of the great archaeologists from 19th century Ireland. So the late 19th century was a period of tremendous archaeological research, development, knowledge gain, and it's coming from the awareness that the sort of ordinary population have a wealth of knowledge, and they're tapping into it in musically, artistically, from a poet point of view, writing texts. It's just really an extraordinary time. The marriage of the old Gaelic world as it's vanishing fast and the newly emergent Protestant awareness of the landscape that they had wrecked, taken over, colonized, and now are awakening to its richness. So it's really, and that's why Cool is at the center of all of that. And Lady Gregory is the grand dame of it. You know, she was a wonderful woman.
So now let's dive into your recent discovery. So you found a new Bronze Age fort close to her home site. How did you first come across this site?
Well, it's very peculiar because I have worked on hill forts and found many hill forts in Sligo, Knocknashee, the Hill of the Fairies, lots of river forts along the Shannon, massive sites, Loch Carra, 26-acre fortress. So it's an area I'm very interested in and have published on before. But at Cool Park, and I've worked around the lake, I was preparing a field trip for the University of Notre Dame, which I work with, to the area. And as a school child growing up, we'd have been brought to Cool Park by one of our teachers who runs. So it's an area we were very familiar with. But within the lake of Cool, there's a townland. So Ireland is divided up into these land divisions that are 1500 years old. And one of the names is Dún Owen. Dún, a very common name meaning fortress. Owen, and I said, Dún Owen, there has to be Dún in Dún Owen. So Dún normally refers to a stone fortress. And then I was doing some other digging and I found out that two Cork archaeologists some years back, maybe 20 years ago, had noted a rampart across what looked like a peninsula jutting into the lake. And they had looked at it and dismissed it as of dubious antiquity. And this is where archaeologists can get themselves tied up in knots. So I'm looking at their reports in of dubious antiquity. They're assuming because it's in this very large estate that it's a folly. It's built by the Lady Gregory's husband's family as part of something to delight the eye and excite the palate as you come into your big house on a carriage. Mm-hmm. So within domains, you often have fake antiquities because you've newly arrived and you create a false ancestry by building them to pretend, oh, we've been here since the Bronze Age when you've just arrived in the 17th century. So anyway, I had a look at this and I said, that doesn't make sense. It's 2 miles from the house. To get to it, you have to go down along the lake. You have to beat your way. You have to climb up onto a rock island, rock table. So it's absolutely doesn't work at all as a folly because of where it's located. But then when I got to it, it's still very odd because it's within the largest Turlough in Ireland. So Turlough is a seasonal lake we get in the Carse landscapes of the South Connacht, the Burren area, South Mayo. So these are where the water table is close to the surface and it goes up and down. So I had hints from an excavation series along a roadway that was built close by about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the archaeologists there said there's so much Bronze Age material on this road scheme, but there was no hill fort near it. Okay. No hill forts, and this is a sort of subset of them. We have these very large fortresses in Ireland and across Europe from around 1200 BC to 800 BC. And I was saying, wow, if there's a lot of Bronze Age material and the archaeologists are wondering where the hell is the central place of this, perhaps this is the site. So I went down, had a look, climbed up, and this is not a folly. It's a very large rampart on the it's on the southern side of this peninsula. It's 29 meters across, 5 meters high. And then I bent my way to this rock table. And as I went along it, heavily wooded, eyeless, if you like, I found the rampart. So the rampart is covered in very thick vegetation. But here and there where trees had fallen, you can see the rampart. And it encircles an area sort of 360 meters long. Quite a narrow, so very unusual topographically, 80, 90 meters, and it's bounded by the lake. In wintertime, it becomes an island in the lake. In summertime, with the lake level drops, the lake water drops through these underwater channels, so it's like a treacherous place because you've got all these little sinkholes edging the rock table, so it's quite a fascinating site. There's no other site in Ireland like it because it's on a rock table 8 to 10 meters high in a lowland environment, but within a very unusual labyrinth of seasonal lakes that exit onto Galway Bay at Kinvara, the beautiful coastal village about 15 kilometers north of it. So it's really exciting to find, very unusual. And of course, in the Bronze Age in Ireland, from around this period, 800 to 1000 BC, we have a very large amounts of gold artifacts and bronze artifacts being deposited in water bodies. So this fortress is within a larger lake with perfect sinkholes or ritual deposit areas. So it could have been a ceremonial enclosure as well as a defensive fort. So a fortified village is what we think these sites were. And when you walk around it, you can see in places where it has been demolished or partially demolished in the past. So part of the rampart has been literally slighted or knocked down the cliff into the lake. So it's that's fairly typical of research we're finding now right across Europe, where these large forts, and some of them in Ireland are as big as 120 hectares.
But it's long.
These are regional kings that are building these forts. So they are very significant parts of a late Bronze Age society, sort of immediately pre-Celtic almost. So the very, and you get them in France, you get them across the Alpine area. Professor Rudiger Krauss of Frankfurt Institute of Archaeology, he's currently working on a whole range of them across Central Europe. And you find them in the Paris Basin. And Bursu was a really interesting archaeologist from, he was head of the institute in Frankfurt up until the 1940s. He fled west. He worked on the Isle of Man, but also ended up as professor here and excavated at Freestone Hill in Kilkenny. And that hill fort had Roman material from it. So they range in date. This site has not been excavated because it's within a beautiful reserve. Coote Park is one of our many national parks, if you like. And so it's unlikely it'll be excavated anytime soon because it's in a protected landscape and there's no threat to it. You know, about five archaeologists have ever been on the site, maximum. So it's not in the public domain. And very few archaeologists have got to it because they can't find it.
I believe so.
I'm not casting doubt, but I'm one of these archaeologists who beat my way through bushes, through bogs, through seaweed to get to stuff. So if I get a hint or something there, I don't hang around. Like I move. I'm not so great on technology, but I used to direct a national survey program. We did lots of flying. They're now using LIDAR, which is transformed. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to do LIDAR on this site because there will be house sites in it. There'll be entrances. There'll be a very elaborate complex within this, which is still overgrown, which we're really at the beginning of our analysis of it. And that's for somebody else to do. Mm-hmm. My job is to identify them and let somebody else do the excavation. Uh-huh.
Can you explain what LIDAR does for the audience that doesn't know?
So LIDAR basically is you're sending light beams effectively down and you're stripping off all the vegetation. So it's like just peeling back the forest cover and all the built structures will be revealed without the vegetation cover. So it's transformative in forested areas. And we have very little forested areas in Ireland. It also works in shallow peat where the features are a gobabachas and porthoc, just peeping out of the bog. So it's, and we're using it now on the coastal zone area because I've done a lot of work recently mapping similar sites to this. So this is a lake fortress, but we have very similar ones on the coast of Ireland, the prominent reports, and we've identified a series of them on the rivers as well. So very recently I found a number of comparable sites on Loch Carra. It's a karst landscape in Mayo, a huge site, has a choke point in the lake. Some of these sites are clearly designed to control routeways across the landscape, trading routes, transport routes at the borders of what were kingdoms at the time. And almost all of them that have been excavated, and in Ireland we've had Professor Billy O'Brien from Cork, a wonderful professor. He's excavated a series of similar sites to this, and many of them are showing evidence of being destroyed by fire.
Oh, okay.
And this is evidence which is being repeated now by Rudiger Krauss, professor, in his studies of the ones in Central Europe, where clearly this, you're in a period of, you know, these are warring kingdoms, and these are those tribal bases. And they're being attacked on a regular basis, and they tend to end in flames and are abandoned. So they're abandoned about 800 BC, and a handful of them stagger on to the Iron Age and into Roman material. We're now identifying some Roman material from Ireland, which is really a whole new fascinating phase of these monuments.
Mm-hmm. And you were digging nearby too, like close to Dublin? Of a few days, we go to that later after looking at the Bronze Age fort, but it will be interesting for you as an audience also.
Well, one of the most exciting, and it'll be a defining monument in the Irish landscape, is we have Roman material from Ireland. So the Romans described the Irish as a people riven by faction, prone to internecine strife, a warlike, gluttonous and incestuous lot. So the Romans aren't impressed by Ireland at all.
I think they call it Hibernia, isn't it? Like
Hibernia,
the
that's
land of winter.
the word they use to describe the Irish are the Scoti, the Scots. Now they push up into Scotland because I was up there recently and doing field work. And so they built the Antonine Wall up in central Scotland between Edinburgh or between Perth and Dumbarton. And they get their belly full kicked by the Scots and the Picts. They retreat to Hadrian's Wall. And then they say, right, if the Scots in Ireland are anything like the Scots in Scotland, they can have Ireland. So they're controlling Ireland from the west coast of Wales, where there are a number of naval bases, Roman naval bases. But recently we have identified Christina Baker, who's excavating this enormous site. It's 46 acres, maybe 20 hectares, just north of Dublin. And what she is finding there looks like to be a Roman trading post. It's just full, all the material is all Roman. It's not a Roman site, it's an Irish site within a 46 acre ramparted fortress abandoned sometime in the 3rd century. And Christine, and it's just been bought by the local government there. So the excavation is bringing, it's going to be transformed because we know this site is Roman material is being vectored through this site into the rest of Ireland. And though we have very little Roman material in Ireland, it tends to find it where Bursu was excavated, a famous German archaeologist, Gerhard Bursu, who came here, excavated Freestone Hill. So he identified Roman material. We have it at Newgrange, we have it at Tara. These are significant royal sites. So otherwise it's pretty thin on the ground, given that we're right next to Roman Britain. Anyway, so there's lots of new material coming out. So archaeology is a very exciting subject. I hope I'll get that across.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So so trading was a big thing. Also, warfare was a big thing. We have much more complex connections than we thought before. And we have lots of evidence of trade. Is there also a lot of evidence of ritual activity associated with the site? You said it's in the middle of the lake. You have
That's what's fascinating, because we have we have juggernaut folds of artifacts from the late Bronze Age in Ireland, and they tend to be found in what they were found in sort of boggy conditions, which were sacred pools. So this whole lake complex, if you can imagine, Cool Lake rises and falls by up to 5 meters between winter levels. So it's one of these magical landscapes that, you know, you arrive wondering, where's the lake on? And I left my camera, my lovely long lens, when I went out to photograph it. And I said, I forgot all about it. I came back a month later. The camera was in the under about 3 meters of water, and some pike probably has it for breakfast. So these are classic ritual landscapes in terms of deposition of gold artifacts, bronze artifacts, bent swords were ritually deposited. And this is a feature you find right across, Gaul into the Germanic world and into further east, into the Balkans as well. So in Ireland, we have, because of our boggy landscapes, we have enormous amounts of Bronze Age ritual deposition surviving from both the early Bronze Age with gold from 2000 BC, and then later on again in the sort of 1100 BC, this sort of period, which is the time we think this fort was built. So Dún Owen, the fortress of Owen in Cool Park, is still sitting. It's a little bit of float in time and space. You know what I mean? We have no definitive dates on it yet, but its architecture, its form fits better as a fortress from the late Bronze Age. You know, when all of this metalworking has been traded, there's lots of transcontinental contact with Britain and with Europe, and similar cultures seem to be emerging. These warlord states right across a big swath of Western and Central and Middle Europe, if you like.
Okay, if you compare that fort with Bronze Age structures in Europe, especially like Germany and Austria, how does it compare to that? So it's bigger, smaller?
Well, this one is, well, you know, you have the oppidum, which are a little bit later in date, but we're now finding them in southern France, which are have a Bronze Age underpinning of them. There's 300 hill forts in France, for example, that will be related to this. And there's many, many more in continental Europe that Professor Rudiger Krauss is working on at the moment. So they're, you get them on river bends, on the Danube River as it burns around. You're getting them on high bluffs, on peninsulas jutting into valleys. So you're getting inland promontory forts. And then you're getting like large hilltop fortresses as well. So they're very, very similar to the ones here. We have probably doubled the number of hill forts now. Some of them are so large that I remember some of the ones that I was involved in identifying, Balting Glass, 120 hectares. You know, there's 5 or 6 kilometers of ramparts around it. And we walked over it before we saw it. And we did aerial surveys of it. So some of them are on a scale that are hard to get your head around. And many of them are used for relatively short periods of time. They're maybe in use for 200 years and then they vanish in the landscape again.
Okay.
And you get them in clusters very often as well. So you don't just get one. This is why this site is very interesting. It's down the road at Mughan. Mughan is near Dromoland Castle, the seat of the O'Briens, which is just near Shannon Airport. There is a 40-acre site there, a very large hill fort with multiple phases, and that with massive wooden gates on it. It's now a collapsed site, as all these sites are. You know, when you're looking at these monuments, you're looking at their last phase of use. You never see them with the soldiers intact. You know, their gates are tumbled, the walls are a tumble. But so the excavations are very important because only a tiny percentage of these sites will ever be excavated. Because it's expensive, and they're, if they're not threatened, why dig them? But they are really insightful because it's a really fundamental period in European history, the late Bronze Age.
And at Heuneburg, they told us that a lot of sites were left because the resources were scarce, like wood, and they didn't reforest the place, and that's why they had to take longer distances, and after a while it wasn't like resourceful anymore. Would this be also with that fort, that it was left because of that? That they took the wood around the fort?
Oh yeah, certainly. I mean, the scale of timber usage in these forts is enormous. You know, so they are denuding the landscape of timber. We can see that from recent discoveries that have been made on Loch Carrob, which is close by, where there's loads of log bolts. So there's a whole new phase of discovery going on. And one of the things which are probably we may find in Cool Lake are the log bolts, because they would have been moving across these seasonal lakes by log bolts or dugout canoes. And we're finding loads of them now in the lakes just north of it, on Loch Carrob. And the early log bolts are all in oak. But from 2000 BC onwards, they're all in pine, Scots pine. So the oaks are used up very early on. So it's a prize. It's a prize. Prize three to use, but they were heavily exploited. One of the sites that we found recently, which is parallel to this one, is one on Cullenmore Island. It's an island in Clew Bay, the biggest island on Clew Bay on the west coast of Mayo. And one of the things we're concerned of is sea level rise. Now, archaeologists don't get too upset about sea level rise.
Because then it's safe, isn't it?
Because we've a long lens. So the sea has been rising for the last 14,000 years. So, you know, to get us overly excited about the latest Green Party giving out about sea level rise, we have a sort of a more... not cautious approach, but a realistic approach, if you like. So, but in this site, the ramparts, hundreds of meters long, you have a headland, a narrow isthmus going out to the island. And I noted two banks running across it. And I said, wow. So I went out at low tide, and one of the local people were cutting seaweed off it. So I asked one of the men, would he cut the seaweed off the bank? He said, cut it yourself. So as I cut it, the stone rampart revealed, and this rampart is drowned twice a day with the incoming tide. So when the tide is in, it's not you don't see it. When the tide is out, it's a whole mile-long sand or gravel bank with halfway across these massive ramparts. Mm-hmm. And so this is telling us this fort, when it was built, was a headland fort, a promontory fort, but it was not in the sea. So we've had mm-hmm. very significant sea level rise since some of these forts were built, by as much mm-hmm. as 4 meters. And on the south, on the Cork coast, of course, we have megalithic mm-hmm. tombs in the water. So the coastal zone has been very increasingly impacted. We have hundreds of coastal promontory forts. So we have the coastal version of the Dunoan fortress, and many of them now are being battered and badly damaged, and some are being actively destroyed by coastal erosion. And some of these sites are enormous sites.
Mm-hmm. How can those sites be protected if they're like in the water, or does the water protect the...
No, we can't really protect them. What we can do, and what we're very poor at in Ireland, we don't have a rescue archaeological unit.
Ah, okay.
So we have a really superb discovery unit focused on discovery and long-term research, very like the institute in Frankfurt. But we don't have, for all sorts of not very well understood reasons, we don't have, given the scale of the resource, Ireland is incredibly rich archaeologically, but we don't have a dedicated rescue unit that will go in when these sites are being actively eroded. So one of the jobs I do in winter, I walk the shore, I monitor some of these big fortresses, which the ramparts are literally being pulled down, houses are being demolished on them, just through coastal erosion. Because this winter in particular, mm-hmm. we had a number of massive storms. And mm-hmm. every storm is destroying a page of history we haven't yet read, and revealing another one that's waiting to be read. And so it's a big issue here, our coastal zone monitoring. So there's more attention to it now, but the resources aren't going in yet. We're hopeful, because the Irish government, for a change, has got deep pockets, and lots of money has been. We're spending a lot of money on road building, mitigation, on archaeological work, but not enough yet on coastal mitigation, because there's a richness out there. Our coastal landscapes are so mm-hmm. rich. Our islands. And the coastal zone, and they are being impacted by sea level rise, but it's been going on for thousands of years, so our awareness of it, I suppose, has increased dramatically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the site that you discovered, it's not like there's not much erosion at that point, so this wasn't really the big concern, or when you discovered
it is a concern, because many sites I've discovered are being eroded. So we have several sites. There's one in Achill Sound, Dún Laoghaire.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic site between Achill Sound and Achill. It's a stone fort on an islet guarding an entrance between the two islands. And it's got the most incredible archaeology on it. And that's actively being destroyed at the moment. And there's nobody working on it, which is really driving me insane, because mm-hmm. I have been campaigning for it to be excavated. So it's a great, mm-hmm. great pity. And there's many sites like it. We have hundreds of sites being actively eroded along the west coast and south coast at the moment. So we have not yet focused on it as an issue. We have one site, Furter's Cove, Furter's Castle, the discovery. It's on the Dingle Peninsula. Again, a very large promontory fort that we now have Iron Age dates from the 2nd to 4th century BC. Very interesting site on the Dingle Peninsula. So we're in a phase of discovery and research, but we need a bit more in terms of managing the coastal change, which is happening rapidly now.
To conserve it, it's also important to present it to the public, isn't it? Are there museum exhibitions or reconstructions or digital visualizations that people can take a look at? Or
the discovery program, which is based in Dublin, but they're working, they have a wide remit, and they're using every technique known, and so they're doing really wonderful work on visualization and bringing it to work. But we need about 4 discovery programs, so it's a dedicated research arm of the state. It's independent of the university systems, but clearly they work closely with them, and they work with independent scholars like myself, and they are very good at sort of making the bringing to life the archaeology in an accessible form. But we're still fairly behind that, though, in terms of people of, like, I don't like comparing ourselves with the British, but I do concern with the Scottish, and they're ahead of us. Are the Danes, you know, small countries of comparable size, we're still considerably behind them in their resources and approach. But we're getting better. And there's lots of exciting new archaeologists going on at a local level through community archaeology. So that's one of the new trends in Irish archaeology, getting much more, which I've been doing all my life. Mm-hmm. Because that's where I'm from. I'm from a background of community activism in a small place. And it has been hugely valuable for me as a scholar.
And more people see more. So if you are conscious about what are you, what's in your surroundings, you may find something, and then you can say, okay, maybe this is of importance, and you can give it to a person that you know who has knowledge about it, because otherwise it gets lost. And
well, in Ireland, people value land enormously, so we don't get the big transfers of land here. So there is a historic memory among most families. They may not know what context it is, but they know it's, if it's been there for 4,000 or 5,000 years, we better leave it alone. So there's still the echo of the traditional protection in Ireland was afforded these monuments was by the Shi, the spirit world protected these monuments. Mm-hmm. And while that tradition, though, has faded now, it's still there in the West, in Kerry and Cork, all along the western seaboard. Mm-hmm. You know, we're finding more sites than we're losing. That's the really interesting thing, you know. Mm-hmm. People think I sneak outside late at night to build monuments only for them to be reported on podcasts like this one.
No. Oh, no.
It's not true. It's a wild, vicious rumor that it's going on throughout the archaeological community in Ireland. You know, how come he's fighting all this stuff? Because I'm active. I'm out. I'm there. I fly. I hike. I walk. I dive. So, and I talk to people. And so all those techniques are very valuable as a field scholar. So landscape archaeology isn't rocket science. Like, I can't use a computer terribly well, but I can read the landscape fairly well. And the karst landscapes around Coole Park are just really very different from where I live here. But they're absolutely extraordinarily rich in antiquities.
Mm-hmm. What was the most surprising or moving moment in the excavation process for you personally? It doesn't have to be Coole Park, it can be something different. So what was the most surprising or heartfelt moment where you're like...
Well, I won't give you one, but I'll give you a recent one. I was doing a lecture on Dunowen Fort, preparing it for an archaeological conference I was doing, and I was setting it in a national context, and out of left field a conversation comes into my head from a man called Paddy Bike, or Paddy Coyne. Everyone here has nicknames. So he lived on his own in a little mountain cottage. And this conversation, we were chatting over a few drinks at a conference called Bog Week, in celebration of bogs, held in Letterfrack, a village near where I live. And Paddy said, he said, Michael, you know, opposite my house, there's a walled island in the lake. And I remember this conversation, having forgotten it for 30 years. So I went down, a friend of mine has a lake boat. So I said, Jeremy, any chance taking me out to the lake? And we went down to this lake. And this lake is where Oscar Wilde's parents had a home on Loch Fee. And where Oscar Wilde fished as a boy, where his mother wrote her accounts of the folklore, where her father, a brilliant scholar. Anyway, I went down the lake, pulled back the rhododendron, because it's now overgrown with rhododendron, and there's a walled island in the lake. And this happened this year. So an extraordinary, and these are really important. So this is like a miniature version of Dunowen. And it's a stone, and these lake dwellings are paralleled with sites in Donegal, in Kerry, one site in Kerry, Loch Adoon on the Dingle Peninsula, and right across the Outer Hebrides. So in Scotland, so that lovely island chain where I have done some fieldwork also, but that was just a lovely memory. Because Paddy Bike was a musician, a hill farmer, but knowledgeable, and he just, and he threw this, but I never followed up on it 30 years ago because I probably drank too much at the conference. And but what it was, it's what has happened. It's what has happened to me over 40 years. People will sidle up, they trust you, they know where you're from. They may not be trained, and no, certainly aren't. They're just ordinary people, hill farmers or fishermen, but they have a knowledge, deep knowledge of their landscape. And every now and then they'll drop into the conversation something that might seem very, just very slight, like, oh, there's a walled island. A walled island is an important, it's a crannog, it's a lake dwelling. It's the richest archaeological monuments we have in the Irish landscape. So that was a recent discovery, which I have yet to report it to the National Monument Service. So anyway, it's that recent. So that type of experience is what I treasure as much as what will be in the actual monument itself.
Mm. So the first thing that we found out about Bronze Age and stuff like that in Ireland, we went to one of the museums in the West. I'm not sure if it was Letterfrack, but they had an exhibition piece which was bog butter. And I was like looking at it, and I was like, bog butter. And it took like 5 minutes to find out. Okay, sure. Butter is one of the main pieces that you put for sites that you want to give to the gods or the fairies or whatever. And then it was a really huge piece. It was like half of my body size. And then it was like, yeah, it's really, really huge thing. And I was like, oh, so there's something on it.
And every year, and we have bog butter being found every year still, because the hand-cut peat is still allowed in the West. So traditional turf cutting still goes on. Mm-hmm. We're not very law-abiding this side of the world, because traditional turf practice goes on. We've been cutting turf for thousands of years, and there's a lot of it's one of the big battlegrounds we have in Connemara, where I live, is the protection of bogs. We've been cutting them for years. The government wants us to stop cutting them. So we're in a sort of standoff between traditional rights and customs, and the need to because bogs are carbon sinks, so they're really, really important to protect them. And they're full of the most, and I found many tombs over the years as the bogs have been cut, houses, field systems. I'm not great on individual artifacts, but occasionally I find them. But people with me often find artifacts. I'm more tuned into the bigger picture, if you like. And I missed a really nice arrowhead or pottery or brooch, as has happened from time to time.
Is there an artifact that you found that you thought, oh, that was the one, my heart went big?
Well, one of the lovely ones on Omi Island, it's a tidal island near where we live. And after every storm, you'll get Bronze Age pottery eroding out of it. You'll get medieval stonework falling down. This is a 6 meter cliff. And I was doing a field trip with NYU University, and it was raining so heavy we abandoned the idea of going to an outer island. So we went to an island you could walk to at low tide. And we walk onto the island, and this girl called McKenna McFadden, very Irish name, from Donegal. Her ancestors were from Donegal. And she picks up and she hands me, she says, oh, I found a child's brooch. And I looked at it, and it was a 1,200-year-old kite brooch. Incredible artifact, exceptionally rare. It originally had 4 jewels. It's from Omi Island. If you go online, you'll see a lovely article on it. Mm-hmm. And I had been almost 35 years walking this stretch of beach. She's on it for 5 minutes. It had fallen out of a sand cliff, and it's an exquisite art. It was been sort of 8th century bling, holding a beautiful cloak together from a visiting clergyman or Gaelic lord visiting the island monastery. And I can hear them cursing still. Where's my brooch?
Yeah. That's true.
It's a silver alloy. It's a really gorgeous artifact. And so we brought, a month later, we went to the National Museum, and Ryan Loughlin, he's a director, sadly died recently. Lovely, lovely man. And Ryan guided us all through the collection. He was an expert on this type of brooch. So that's one really recent find from Omi Island, which is very, very transformative. And the other site we found in Cosharaga, down in South Connemara, as you know, a whole series, we've got some really new material, new dates coming up. And one of the shell middens we found now, we have a really exciting date from 6000 BC. And lots of archaeology turning up in the storm surges. So we're still finding the drowned landscapes of the Mesolithic are being identified now. So, yeah, so coastal erosion is a problem, but it's also providing us with really interesting new material, because we're now much more aware of the coastal zone, which we have ignored for centuries. But we have lots of nice drowns. So the next program we're going to do, you're going to be doing it on the drowned landscapes of the Irish coastline, because it is very, very interesting. One of the most exciting new projects has been run by Fingal County Council. It's North Dublin. Mm-hmm. Christine mm-hmm. Baker is the archaeologist in charge. And it's a site that about 40 years ago now, Roman material was found at. That Roman material was found by a metal detector, so it was subject to a major law case, and we still don't know what was found. But the local council then acquired the land, 46-acre headland fortress north of Dublin on a beautiful promontory. And Christina Baker has been, over the last 5 years, excavating sections of it, very tiny sections of it. And she has now confirmed that it is a major trading hub. So it's an Irish site, trading with Roman Britain, probably, but also further afield. The Roman world, of course, is huge, with Gaul, possibly Iberia, and further afield. Because one of the odd things about the Irish landscape, we're right close to Roman Britain, but very little Roman material. The big motorways along the east coast, which are built between Belfast and Wexford, hardly a shard of Roman pottery was found on it. But we do get Roman material in monasteries from the very late antique world, from Bordeaux, from Spain, from Antioch, from Eastern Europe. But the core Roman material, we've only a handful of material. It comes up at Cashel, the Rock of Cashel. We have a Roman fibula there, so clearly a pre-Christian centre. We have some from Newgrange, Roman gold. Biggest collection of Roman gold from Ireland is at Newgrange tomb. Famous Neolithic tomb, but it was clearly an important site. The Romans operate in the shadows, like any big imperial power. They're good at war, but they're also good at diplomacy. So these seem to be diplomatic gifts given to Irish kingdoms to placate them or buy them off or create client states. So Tara, mm-hmm. we have Roman glass vessels from Tara. We have a couple of Roman burials from Kilkenny. We have some Roman material from Lambay Island off the coast and from Bray. And then we have Roman material from North Donegal, which looks like it might have been troops fighting in the Roman army that the Romans are recruiting from beyond the frontier. And we have one reference possibly to the Scoti from, I think it's from Trier on the Roman frontier, a list of barbarian troops. And so we may have actually Irish troops in the empire. But up to now, we have no sort of really textbook site. And Bursu's excavations, Professor Bursu, who came here in the 1940s, he excavated Freestone Hill, and we have really important Roman material from there. So it's a hill fort. So, but this site that's currently being excavated is really fascinating because it wasn't subsequently occupied. It's an Iron Age site. So it's huge ramparts on its landward side, flat inside, and geophysical survey have revealed a series of buildings, round buildings, so they're not Romans. The Romans, the nice thing about them, you know, when they arrive, they work to a plan. They don't sort of make it up. You can see the Romans the minute they step foot anywhere. They build their marching camp, they build their camp. Everything is done, organized, highly sophisticated. They're an imperial power. So they, so this Ratgal site is, or not the Ratgal, the Drumanna site at Loch Shinny is going to be transformative in terms of the influence of the Roman world. Because the Roman world does come to Ireland through Patrick and Christianity, the late antique world, the last gasp of Christianity. Ireland adopts Christianity. So we are Romanized through religion, but not through occupation. And it's late, so it's from the 5th, 4th, 5th centuries. But we do now have evidence of earlier settlement However long it lasts, we're not sure. It seems to have been abandoned around 3rd century, 300 or a little bit later. But it's full of Roman pottery, Roman artifacts. It looks like they might have found the social club. So really, really interesting material. Anyway, Christine is really good at presenting it to the public, and it was an open day excavation. So very, very exciting.
It looks good. I think it's also, it was like they had the money or they had the goods, and then people tried to get them because it was like new fashion. So they probably heard about, okay, it's new fashion in Wales, it's new fashion in Scotland, and Gaelic ladies also wanted to have those new things. I think it's the same. It's 3,000, 2,000 years ago that you hear that somewhere else there's something high fashion and you want to have that too.
Yeah, Irish wolfhounds.
Yeah, that's true.
What means archaeology for you? Is it a job or is it Berufung?
Passion.
Or is it a passion for you?
I know, it's both. It's what I do. It's in my bones.
Okay.
So it's been a lot, since I was 17, I've been mapping the landscape. And it's the one thing I'm not very good at pretty much anything else, but reading the landscape, exploring it, sharing it with people, that's what I spent a lifetime doing, continuing to do it.
And do you think history is important for our living today? Or how big is the influence?
Impact.
It's all around us. Like, I live in a place where there was no towns. You know, towns were colonial. The Irish didn't like people who lived in towns. They burnt people who lived in the Irish. Yeah. So I'm from the Gaelic West, if you like. The nice thing about Ireland, it's all around us. It's nodding, it's looking down from this hill, from that lake. It's part of our mental map landscape as we travel through it, and you're nodding at the past all the time. So it's informing me anyway. We're lucky we have this incredible ensemble of stage props from the past informing our present. And so that's the world I live in. And some people see it, but I happen to see it all the time. You know, it's just ever present in what I do. How I live.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
It was lovely to talk to you. Thank you, yes. Michael, for going all through this and
for your time.
Sorry about the mess up with your stay, but as you can see, we're not terribly